Blog Talk Radio.
January 10th, 2015 episode of John Talk Radio. My special guest tonight is Brian Buchanan of the band Jubilee Riots. Brian, welcome to the show. Are you with us? Let's see. I can't hear Brian. Let's see if we can... We can do. You never know what's going to go on. Let's play another song, see if we can. Get Brian on the line here. Brian, can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, Brian. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Yeah, I heard the whole song and I've heard you so far. Can you hear me now?
What's happening with my I hate to make excuses, but I'm going to make one.
All right.
I have an old Toshiba, and the touchpad on it is comes and goes. So.
Oh, okay.
But I apologize for that.
Not at all. I could hear you loud and clear, and I was hoping the problem wasn't on my end because I'm just sitting backstage in a little venue somewhere on an iPhone, and I wouldn't really have known what to do.
Well, hi.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thank you so much, Brian. I really appreciate you coming on. I was trying to hit the certain buttons, and I thought, oh, okay, it's not working tonight. So we got it going, and I really appreciate it. So I just want people to know that the website is JubileeRiots.com. The newest release that you have is Penny Black, and they can pick that up on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play, all the good download sites. And so let's talk about the band. I know that you've been, Enter the Haggis was the band before. Talk about that, Brian, how the current band that we have today, how they came together. And then we'll try to get into how you got started and your musical career. But let's start with the band, and maybe if you could introduce the members.
Sure, I can do that. It's actually, we actually haven't had any personnel changes. We just sort of we started going under a new name. So the band is myself, Brian Buchanan, and I play electric acoustic guitars and keyboards and fiddle, and I do some of the singing, some of the lead vocals, and I split those duties with Trevor Lewington, who's the other guitar player in the band and the other songwriter, and he sings a lot of lead vocals, including on that first song you played there, Cut the Lights. We've got a guy who plays just about everything, Craig Downey. On stage, you can see him play anything from bagpipes to trumpet to harmonica, tin whistle, guitar. He's kind of a utility guy, and we use him for a lot of different flavors and colors over the course of an evening, which is a lot of fun. Our drummer is Bruce McCarthy, and our bass player is Mark Abraham.
Now, how long has the band been together?
Well, as you alluded to, the band was formed as Enter the Haggis in the late 90s, and we've been together for the most part for, I think, I'm just past 14 years now in the band, so it's been quite a while. The only new member of the band since then is Bruce, our drummer, who joined about 5 years ago.
What's the secret of keeping a band together? Because that's something I ask a lot. I know some bands that have been together for a very long time, and I know some, Brian, that have a rough time staying together. What would you say is the formula or the secret for keeping your band together with a core member of people?
Well, I mean, we've never really been a band that's had much in the way of ego problems. We all kind of grew up loving music and loving playing music, and none of us ever really had aspirations of being a diva or a world-famous rock star. I think we just really enjoy what we do, and we tend to be pretty laid-back guys. The last few years, of course, everybody's got iPods and laptops and things, so those 12-hour days in the van are a little bit easier to stomach when you can watch TV shows and kind of go into your own little world and not necessarily have to just be each other's entertainment and conversation pieces. So that helps.
Yeah, that's a big thing right now. People can escape into their own worlds. But, talk about how the band formed and how did you guys get together?
Well, we came together sort of playing a lot of the Irish pubs and sort of local rock venues in Toronto, which is where we're from. And it took us a little while to sort of find our feet, and we went through a few different kind of artistic makeovers, I guess, over the years, where as we sort of learned what it was that we really enjoyed playing what we did together well. And in those days, we were a bit more of a sort of Celtic rock fusion band, played a lot more sort of traditional Irish and Scottish things in pubs, and then sort of gradually learned how to write songs and replaced, you know, it's the same sort of story you hear from bands all over the place who used to play Mustang Sally and Freebird, and little by little managed to write enough songs they didn't have to play those ones anymore. Yeah, I mean, there was a guy who was playing with the band just very briefly just before I joined, and he was a friend of mine, and when he wasn't able to commit to sort of doing it full-time, he recommended me. I was supposed to fill in just for a weekend while they found somebody else, and here it is 14 years later.
That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
What do you think it is that keeps you guys as a unit and to continue to search for new music and ways to be creative? I think that's one of the things. And also I can kind of tag into that, Brian, with how does the distribution of the songwriting go in the band?
Well, Trevor and myself are sort of the main songwriters. We try to make the arrangement process as collaborative as possible. Just because nobody wants to get on stage and play a part somebody taught them, you know? So we try and sort of make sure that everybody's sort of voice and their own inspirations kind of come through in the way that a song gets fleshed out. And we listen to a lot of music, and because we all come from very different musical backgrounds, you're never really sure what's going to come out. You know, like Bruce and Mark both studied jazz and Latin and world music in college, and Craig grew up playing in pipe bands and listening to Rush and AC/DC and Rolling Stones. And I was actually raised a classical violinist and piano player, and my mom was a musical theater teacher. So we have a lot of different flavors that we can draw upon, and you never really know. And honestly, I mean, our number one asset is a really forgiving and really trusting fan base, because they've always, you know, they've always supported us through all the various artistic choices that we've made. And some of them worked well, some of them have been mistakes, but we've always had the freedom to experiment and sort of spread our wings that way, which is really, really amazing.
Well, that's a really great point I wanted to talk about. When you're writing your songs, I believe you said you and Trevor are writing most of the songs.
Yeah.
Do you have like a, I don't know, a certain sound that you're going for, or do you have the freedom, Brian, to just say, okay, you know, we're going to start writing music, we're going to start being creative, and we're not going to stay within maybe the boundaries that we've laid down before? And sometimes that can be very good for a band, and sometimes it can be a little challenging for the fan base, like you said. How do you guys approach that?
Well, for us, I mean, We always try not to repeat ourselves. So if there's anything that we're doing that we feel is too much like something we've done before, it's not as exciting for us. So, yeah, I mean, we've kind of come to terms with the fact that no matter what kind of a song it is that Trevor writes or that I write, it's going to sound like our band because of the five of us playing, you know. And we all have sort of distinctive styles of playing and distinctive types of parts and lines and melodies that we'll write. So, you know, it's been amazing because I can write a country song and then a prog rock song and then a pop song. And by the time the band is sort of done tinkering with them, you can put them on the same album and it doesn't sound completely schizophrenic.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
We have fought with that in the past. And we used to have a little bit too much of a tendency to sort of, you know, we'd write a country song or like a bluegrass rock song or something, and then we would chase that direction too far to a point where we were just sort of doing a caricature of the genre, and then we'd give up on that genre and go on to something else. So I think we're getting a little bit better at keeping things centered and, you know, not chasing our tails too much.
Yeah, I think that's always an interesting thing. I love seeing musicians and bands grow. You know, you listen to the first album and you kind of see how they grow. And sometimes I think that it can be a challenge for the marketing part of it, because you get that fan base and they're thinking, gosh, this doesn't even sound like them. But I kind of like that part where the band is kind of knocking down the fences and allowing to be creative and to kind of move. But that also can be a little challenging for people to say, wow, that doesn't even sound like them.
Well, absolutely, it can. And I mean, if you went back and listened to the first things that we released and then compared them to Penny Black, it'd be kind of hilarious. I mean, it you may as well be a completely different band playing a completely different genre of music at times, which is part of what motivated us to try and actually change the name of the band and sort of rebrand ourselves as something new, because we've been evolving away from that original sound for so many years now. I mean, we've been together for so long, and it started feeling a little, almost a little dishonest to still sort of pretend that people who liked Enter the Haggis in 2002 should be expected to just swallow Penny Black as an Enter the Haggis album when there's very little overlap in styles, and we've just kind of, you know, we've grown into different musicians, and we like the idea of it kind of standing on its own as its own thing and not necessarily being judged directly against our archives, because, you know, nobody's the same musically, artistically, or personally after 14 or 15 years, and it was a really tough decision, and our fans, for the most part, have been very, very supportive of it. There's definitely always going to be a few people who are disappointed and feel like you're leaving your roots behind, you know.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I mean, it was – so the decision was kind of to take it to that level that we talked about, like exploring and experimenting with new sounds and capturing that sound and thinking maybe we have grown out of that. But was there anything else to it? Because I think that a lot of people, and maybe some of the people that are listening, don't understand the current business environment and the marketing way of bands, and how that, you know, it's a lot of fun to play. Everybody loves to do that. But you also, there's that, how do you make a living side of it? And how do you get your, how do you get your, like you said, the branding, how do you get people to know that you're out there?
I can tell you it's been a heck of a challenge so far, and will continue to be. Just getting the word out that the name has changed and that the Jubilee Riots album, they might be suggested someone on Facebook, is actually Enter the Haggis, who they listened to 5 years ago and have forgotten about since, you know. And we knew that it was going to be a challenge, and that, you know, just about everybody in the music industry who we talked to cautioned us very strongly against changing the name and doing what we've done, because 14 years of building a brand and a name and name recognition is obviously not worth nothing. But at the same time, the name that we felt we had grown was one that was very genre specific, and we've always found that a challenge of a name like Enter the Haggis was that people would have an idea in their head what they were going to be hearing before we even played a note. And you know, it's just, it's a name that really made sense for the band we were in 2001. But the music that we play now is, it's a variety of genres, and any one of which might be as prevalent in any given song as a Celtic or Irish kind of sound or a Scottish sound. And we sat back and we listened to the new record when it was finished, and we realized how confusing it would be for a new fan to hear the name Enter the Haggis and then listen to that album. And we kind of felt like we wanted a bit of a clean slate, I guess.
And you said you were originally from Toronto?
Yep.
And now you're centered in New York, is that correct?
No, the band would still say that its home base is Toronto, although
okay,
only one of our members actually lives in Toronto now. Trevor lives a couple hours west in Ontario, and Craig lives a couple hours east, and I actually just moved to Philadelphia a couple of days ago. That's going to be home for me, and Mark lives in Maine, so we're kind of spread all over the place.
How is it? I was in several interviews I've had recently. I mean, one of the things that's happened with the internet and file sharing and things like that bands don't have to be in the same room all the time. Now they can, you know, you can lay down tracks, you can send them back and forth to each other. What's your take on that, Brian? Do you think that's, do you like that fact of it, that you guys can work together even though you're miles apart? And what do you compare that with being in a room together and having that energy of the people being right there?
Yeah, I mean, there's advantages and disadvantages to both. You know, Trevor and I will open Dropbox folders and we'll send, you know, basic song sketches back and forth to one another, or we'll make sure that the whole band has access to demos that we recorded before we go to a rehearsal. But when you're arranging a song, as you say, there's really no substitute for everyone sitting down together and kind of getting the vibe of the tune and just even seeing how excited one another are getting by ideas that we have, and, you know, just the sense of, as you say, the energy in the room, there really isn't a substitute for that. I mean, one thing that's incredible for me with the rise of technology the way it is we can do things in the studio where all of a sudden it'll be like, oh, I really wish we could get so-and-so to play, Illin bagpipes or accordion on this song, and you can just get on the phone, call them up, go to their studio, wherever they are. We send them the files, they record their parts, send it back, and, you know, in a day, rather than spending the time and money to fly somebody across the country, you get great parts sent to you in your email inbox, and you can throw them right into the session. So that's something that never would have been possible.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing if you think about it. And
yeah.
And I kind of go back in my mind with that. I think that it's great, and I think it's one of the things that can make the world a lot smaller. It's kind of like with the product of the music right now. Like, you know, it's in a download, and like used to be in the LP form and the vinyl form, and then went through the 8-track and the CD and all that. Do you think there's any importance to that, to have a product in your hands? I know a lot of bands have a hard time giving that up.
Well, I mean, for a touring band, that tours the way that we do, a large part of what puts gas in your tank and keeps you on the road is your merchandise sales. And so
right.
Important because, most of my music that I have is digital. I'm not old-fashioned that way. I'm getting my very first turntable this week, I think. I've never had one before. But I think still it shows people like to be able to walk out of the venue and take the CD they bought and throw it in their car stereo and drive home.
Right,
you know? And
right, yeah.
We don't. And the one thing that had occurred to me recently with vinyl is that part of the reason that bands love vinyl is that you can't make a mixed vinyl. You can't put vinyl on shuffle. You know what I mean? Maybe you can with some turntables, but it's one place where it's too much of a pain for people to actually switch records every single song, and so they're going to listen to your whole album. And if you put an album out that's worth listening to all the way through, your fans are going to get to know your music better. And so there's some value in that. I don't know. I mean, I grew up with CDs. I grew up with opening the CD up and getting the booklet out and learning all the words and reading all the thank yous and all the little inside jokes, and it was kind of an interesting window into the personality of a band. But
right.
Nowadays, the level of access through Facebook and Twitter, and I don't know how necessary that particular form of interaction is anymore. I mean, you've seen that. I don't know.
Yeah, I just think it's interesting. I love it. I have I don't have a big vinyl collection, but I do have quite a few, and I just like Brian just getting the album and looking at it, like the feel of it and the artwork.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's such a cool thing. Although it's separate from the music, but it just to me always had that feeling of almost like an event when you had something like that. But I just wanted your opinion. Yeah.
Opening up you open up a present at Christmas and it's the new album from the band you love, and you can sit there and look at it. And I mean, obviously, it's all part of the branding with the album artwork and the photography and the font choices and all the rest of it. And you can't really do that. You can't really give somebody an MP3 download for Christmas and see the excitement on their face when they open it up. You know?
gift
cards just aren't quite as exciting.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think it's, but it's really, I love it because of the accessibility and it's just amazing. Like I can, somebody can tell me, hey, John, check this out, or they'll send me files and I can listen to it. I don't have to wait. You know, it's like, bam, it's right there. So that's
mm-hmm.
kind of cool. And then you also have the it would be an argument, I'm not sure, Brian, but when people think about the like how much music there is, it's like a glutton of music. There's so much out there.
Oh, man.
So when a band is like, when you guys are marketing your music or when you're talking to people about their music, and the older days, it wasn't that easy to go to another band, I mean, to listen to other music. But now, within seconds, you could say, oh, this band, I don't like that, I'm going to go to something else. How do you think that affects the consumer and whether they can give you enough time to really appreciate your music?
Yeah, I mean, I think it has a vast effect on listening patterns and listening habits. And the average music listener, how many hours a day do they have to listen to music? And if you're putting out an hour-long album, I mean, the difference today, like, you used to need to carry around, if you were a really avid music listener, you'd have a wallet of CDs in your backpack or something you'd carry around to play in cars, or you'd have a few tapes that lived in your car. But Nowadays, if you've got a 150 gigabyte iPod with 30,000 songs on it, if somebody's getting out their iPod to decide to listen to music, they've got it all there right there with them. So I'm not competing with the other band they heard on the radio this week or the other favorite album they have. I'm competing with, you know, the Beatles' entire catalog and everything Pink Floyd ever wrote.
That's a good
every
point.
Time they choose, every time they choose to listen to music, they have to choose my music over just about everything else that they've ever heard or liked. It's all right there in their hands. So I think that does have a big impact on the way people listen to music.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'd never really thought of it that way. But it is true. I mean, it's like you could listen to literally anything. So that's amazing. We started
so
off the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And that's what we kind of go back to that marketing thing. You know, it's like, wow, it takes a lot of thought into it. And I don't think anybody has a complete formula. You can, you know, hey, 1, 2, 3, and this will happen. What do you think, Brian, as far as what would define success, or what does define success for Jubilee Riots?
I think if you asked any one of the five of us, we might give you a different answer. You know, I remember reading that Pamplemousse article that made the rounds a little while ago, where the singer from that band was, or Jack Conte was talking about how, you know, even though they did a tour and they filled houses all across the country and they've sold this many CDs or they've had this many views on YouTube, they still feel as though they are making it. They haven't made it. And I know I can empathize with that. I mean, I've made every penny that I've ever made as an adult, as a musician. And I joined the band when I was 18, right out of high school. So, I mean, I've had a 14-year career thus far of paying my rent and paying my bills and, you know, just by playing songs that I wrote and having people like them enough to purchase them and come see us at concerts. So by most standards, you have to call that success. But at the same time, you know, for somebody else, success might mean having enough money saved up to retire on, or it might mean the size of crowd they play for. I mean, for me, success is being able to travel 2,000 miles and play in a city I've never been to and see somebody in the front row singing along with words that I wrote 3 months ago sitting on my bed in my bedroom, you know?
Yeah.
So every time that happens, it feels like we've had some measure of success anyways.
Yeah, I get that answer. I would say almost 9 out of 10 times, Brian, is the response that you get from your music. That was what most people say it. And
yep.
I agree with that. I think that's probably it. But I also understand that, you know, people are trying to figure out this, how do we take that and, you know, turn it into money.
Yeah.
I can't remember. What was the group you were talking about earlier? Because I was just reading something where they had all the success, but it wasn't really equaling money.
Yeah, the article I was talking about was a band called Pamplemousse, which is Jack Conte and I don't remember the girl, Natalie Dawn, I think is her name.
Oh, okay.
The other girl in the band. And the reason this article is making the rounds is that they had done a tour where they sold out venues all across the country and they itemized exactly how much money came in. It seemed like an awful lot of money. And they sold a ton of T-shirts and a ton of CDs and they seemed to do really well, but of course the tour ended up costing them $20,000 or something when all was said and done. And, you know, part of that was due to the nature of their tour, and I'm not going to get all into that right now, but it is tough, you know. There's not a lot of musicians with private jets flying around, and even musicians who people might think are doing very well sometimes struggle to make a car payment or struggle to make a mortgage payment or, in my case, don't have a car or a mortgage.
Well, I was reading an article, it wasn't too long ago, about, well, you know, this musician, and he was actually, I think it might have been on Facebook, but he was talking about all of this stuff that's out there on the internet that they were getting all these awards and accolades and all these hits, but nobody was buying anything.
Yeah.
And it was like, how do you turn that into a profit? But then, you know, I've talked to a lot of musicians, some that have been around forever and ever, and they're just saying, well, you know, if you stay true to yourself and you play the music and write the music that you think is what you want it to be, then, you know, it'll happen. For you,
yeah, and you know what? If all you're left with is a legacy of albums that you're proud to play for your kids and that you'd be proud for your heroes to listen to, I mean, it's a great legacy to have. You know? At the end of the day, if you look back at what you've created and it's something that you're proud of, then you know, there's certainly no shame in that, regardless of the status of your bank account.
No, I agree with that. I think there's a lot of honor in the fact that musicians and artists do what they want to do and do what I think the world really needs. Because, you know, you can go back, Brian, to like, when kids are in school or, music and art should be at the front for a lot of kids. It doesn't have to be for everyone. But it should be an option for a lot of kids to pick and to really grow and to get their confidence and go into the world. And a lot of times it's not there. And so it's hard for them to get there. And I think when people choose that and, you know, when you can go back and talk to kids about it, hey, you know, it may not be like, going into a certain field, but the feeling that you get from what you're doing when you really love what you're doing is maybe worth it all.
I had this conversation with a friend of mine who worked. He worked the line at an auto parts factory, and by the hour and by the numbers, he made a lot more money than I did. But he hated his job, and he hated getting up to go to work every day, and only got to enjoy the money that he was making sometimes on weekends, and sometimes if he took a little vacation. But the rest of the time, it was slog. Whereas I was making a third, if that, of what he was making, but because I got to do what I love, like, there's definitely a value, maybe just a quality of life value to being able to love what you do and being able to make a living at it and not having to dread getting up to go to work every day. You know?
No, I agree with that.
It's not that what we do isn't hard work, but anybody you know who loves their job, it's never something to dread doing, regardless of what it is.
I totally agree with that. My guest is Brian Buchanan from the band Jubilee Riots, and you can go on their website, jubileeriots.com. Their newest release is Penny Black. Brian, we started the show off with Cut the Lights. Talk about that a little bit, and then we'll play. I'd like to play Two Bare Hands, and if you could kind of set that up also.
Okay. Well, they're both songs that Trevor wrote, so I'm not going to try and get too deep into the lyrics because I don't want to put words into his mouth. The concept of this record was that we had our fans around the world write us letters with their own best story that had happened to them, the story they always thought would make a great song, because everybody's got at least one. And,
well, that's a great idea.
Yeah, I mean, we've got a really diverse and unusual group of people who are fans of our music, and we've heard so many great stories from them in the past, and we were able to give them a chance, and so we made them write it all, handwritten letter that they put in the mail and mailed to us, and nobody does that anymore. And we got about 900 pages of letters from around the world.
Oh, that's awesome.
And so, although not all of the songs are sort of directly inspired by one specific story, or a few of them are, when we read through all the letters, there was a lot of common themes and sort of a lot of universal ideas that ring through. You know, like there would be a couple hundred stories about the first time somebody met the love of their life, or a story about losing somebody who was close to them, or a story about triumphing over some kind of adversity in their lives, and, you know, the sort of things that we all go through. And some of the songs sort of became more thematic in nature. Cut the Lights was one of the more love song-oriented songs. Anyways, that's what Trevor told me. And Two Bare Hands was definitely more directly I just had a speaker come on right behind me standing this hallway. Two Bare Hands was more of a specific story. It was written about a girl named Katie Otten who had sort of always lived in within a short distance of her parents, and had always sort of had the support and the love of her family sort of as a safety net around her. And one day she decided to just sort of take her life into her own hands and moved across the ocean to Scotland to go to university, and kind of had to sort of live on her own and sort of live by her own means for the first time ever. And there was a few stories kind of along those lines too. So Two Bare Hands, that's the hook is, you know, sometimes you will find all you have is your beating heart and your two bare hands.
We'll play that. This is Two Bare Hands from Jubilee Riots, and we'll be right back to continue our conversation with Brian Buchanan.
We're so grateful ones we rely on, who lean back upon us, it seems so strong. But a time comes when there's no one around you. You do all that you can do with your brain and your brawn.
I'd like to welcome you back to John Talk Radio. Tonight our guest is Brian Buchanan of Jubilee Riots, and we just heard Two Bare Hands. So Brian, what's the band working on now? Is there any new projects or anything that you're working on?
Well, we have a bunch of music videos that are nearing completion that are going to sort of start getting rolled out probably this week or over the next couple of weeks. So you can look forward to that, and we've never really done videos before. One of them, we actually got an animator from the UK to do for us for the song Trying Times, and he made this really kind of creepy, bizarre, post-apocalyptic animated video for the song, which we're very excited for people to see. And besides that, you know, we're going into a period of about a month and a half off, which is the first time we've had that in God knows how many years, so I think we're all kind of stepping back a little bit and hoping that the album can sort of generate some of its own momentum and kind of keep things rolling for our touring in the spring when we kind of get back into it.
So you have a tour planned and scheduled for the spring?
Yeah, we're going. We're playing a bunch of shows through March, which is always a big month for us, 'cause it's sort of around St. Patrick's Day.
Right.
And then once March is done, we're heading over to Ireland in April for a tour that we're actually doing with our fans. We've done this a few times before. We sell tickets to our fans to fly over with us, and we all ride around on tour buses together and go see all the sights and sounds and smells and bars of Ireland, and then we play a few shows, and they come to the shows, and we all jam in the hotel bar until 5 in the morning, wake up bleary-eyed the next day and do it all over again. It's always a lot of fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a good time. Have you ever filmed any of that for a video?
Not specifically. We have some footage just sort of from our own personal cameras over the years, but I think this year it's probably the first time we've all got smartphones with good cameras in them, so I'm sure we're going to wind up with more footage than usual.
Yeah, it could be Jubilee Riot's Magical Mystery Tour.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah, that would be great. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I'm also looking forward to the videos, because I think it's interesting when you said you hadn't done them in the past much. Well, what was the decision to do them, and what was the thought into that? Because, you know, that's a good conversation to have also when you as a songwriter, Brian, and you have a song, and then you're going to interpret that into a visual media, which is a little different. How do you approach that?
Well, we hadn't done it in the past, mostly because it was cost prohibitive, and also because until streaming video on the internet kind of really came into its own a few years ago, there was kind of that tough little in between time where it was still expensive to make a music video, but there was nowhere anybody was going to watch it. MTV and VH1 had sort of stopped playing music videos, especially for emerging artists, and you know, not everybody could justify the cost of a professional video if it was just going to be, you know, a little pop-out box on their website. And so the costs have come down a lot, and we've gotten better at doing it ourselves as well. I guess we just sort of figured we wanted to be able to represent these songs visually and to support the branding of the new name of the band and the new project, but also just to sort of show people that it is still the five of us and we're still playing with the instruments. You know, a couple of them are very sort of performance-based videos, and a couple of them are a little bit more figured, I guess. The video for Two Bare Hands, which I won't get too much away about, but it's very largely based around sign language, American Sign Language.
Oh, that's cool.
Which we thought was an appropriate pairing to the name of the song, Two Bare Hands.
And you talked about Trying Times. Is that one of your songs?
Nope, that's one of Trevor's too. I actually only have a couple that I would call my own songs on this album, and then a bunch of them that I had a very strong hand in sort of the arrangement and in production of, but that were Trevor's songs in the York's original.
And how did that start with you guys collaborating? Because I always am interested in that, Brian, how that two people, you know, that have talent in music and songwriting skills can collaborate. Sometimes it works really well and sometimes it doesn't. What is it that works for you guys, and what do you think that's all about? Because that's kind of interesting.
Well, we've always been really supportive of each other's songwriting, and we like a lot of the same music, so our instincts don't tend to run too contrary to one another. When I joined the band, I was in a period of my life where I was writing a lot of songs, and so it sort of naturally flowed in as I introduced sort of a song here or there into the band. And the guys in the band liked my songwriting and sort of liked the way that the songs came across. Trevor wasn't really writing all that much back then, but he has he's really, really exploded as a songwriter. He's far more prolific than I am these days. I don't know. We both learn from one another. Every time we put out an album, I can hear, you know, my influence in his songwriting in more ways, and definitely the other way around as well. You know, I'll hear things in his songs from one album that I really love, and the next time we get to a writing process, I'll be incorporating some of those ideas into my songs. So we don't tend to really sit down together and write songs together very often. It's usually one of us has a verse melody and a chorus, and then the other one will write a bridge melody or figure out an instrumental part or something like that. So I think we've kind of learned each other's strengths and weaknesses and boundaries a little bit, and try not to step on each other's toes too hard.
Now, with Penny Black, did you guys produce it yourself, and how did you do it with the studio? I know a lot of bands do, you know, in their own studios. Did you do that, or did you go to hire a studio? How did that work?
Well, I mean, I would say we sort of co-produced it, I guess. We hired a producer named Jonathan Wyman, who is from Portland, Maine, and we went out there for a month and recorded with him. He has his own studio, and we lived in a cottage on a lake and then went into the studio every day and recorded that way. But prior to actually heading to Maine, we spent about 2 weeks. Our drummer Bruce has a small studio in his house. So we did a couple of weeks of what you call pre-production, where we nailed down, for the most part, pretty finalized arrangements of all the songs, which is often the job of the producer. So by the time we went out to Jonathan's studio, we were probably more prepared in a lot of ways than a lot of bands are when they head to a studio. But he certainly lent his touch, you know, his ideas and his suggestions, and obviously his sort of sonic production of the album was very, very much in evidence when all was said and done, when we went back to listen to it. I mean, it's the same five guys, but this record doesn't sound really a whole lot like the last one, and or a whole lot like the one before that. So it's amazing having that sixth voice in the conversation, how much of a difference it can make.
When you laying the tracks down, Brian, was it in your thought process that that's going to have to be put forth in a concert and the live side of it, the live music side of it? Was that any consideration when you were laying down the tracks in the studio that you would have to at one point play these live, and would they be, was it something that you could do that would, you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
I do. Yeah. I mean, it's always been a focus of ours that we want to be able to replicate what we do in the studio on stage. I think this time we allowed ourselves a little bit more leeway. And you know, every record you do, there's always a couple of songs that are seriously challenging to pull off properly live on stage. This one's tough because I play a lot of different instruments on the album on various songs. You know, on any given song, I might be playing piano and electric guitar and acoustic guitar and violin and singing some of the vocals and playing glockenspiel and synths and all these other things. And so when it comes to a live performance, sometimes you'll have one person playing multiple things. You know, Craig will be playing trumpet for part of the song and then run over to a synth and hit a few notes there and then go back to the trumpet again. Trying to get all those sounds in is definitely challenging, but it's one of the things that makes playing new music live so much fun, and it kind of revitalizes the band and keeps you on your toes, you know.
Yeah, that's always, I think, the lifeblood of a band, but it's also one of the, you know, I've always kind of interested in when you'd go and there's one band that I talked to just recently that they used so much in the studio that there was no way they could do it live, and they knew that. And
yeah.
It was like, yeah, it's going to be kind of difficult to take it out there. And it kind of hindered them from even going live. But I can tell with your sound that you have a real feel for the live crowd, and I think that's such a great thing for a band, because to me there's nothing that equals, you know, a live show when you go hear a band and hear that. So that's really cool. Why don't we play Trying Times, and could you talk about that a little bit? Or
Sure. I mean, that song was inspired by, as I was saying before, the sort of more universal theme of people overcoming adversity in their lives. And there are so many stories about people talking about how the formative experience of their lives were either some terrible illness that they had to overcome, or some difficulty in their family life or their personal life, and how it made them a better person and sort of was the fire that tempered the steel that they managed to carry forward after that. And so Trevor wrote the song Trying Times basically around the idea of that, you know, sometimes in the hardest part of your life, you need the support of people around you, and that we're always going to run into those pitfalls and those trying times.
And this is Jubilee Riot's Trying Times, and we'll be right back. We're back with my guest, Brian Buchanan. The album is Penny Black. The band is Jubilee Riots. Go on jubileeriots.com. Pick it up on iTunes, Google Play, Amazon. I highly recommend it. It's a great album. Brian, thank you so much for taking your time to be on the show tonight.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and thanks for the kind words. We're very excited about the new record.
Is there anything that you would like to touch on that we hadn't talked in the interview? Anything you'd like to say maybe to the fan base or anything I missed?
Well, I mean, we are incredibly grateful that we have the kind of support that we have from our fans. I mean, this is the third record in a row that we've crowdfunded, and they're very literally the kind of fans that we couldn't do what we do without their support, because they know it and they bankroll every crazy idea that we have, and they've stuck with us so far. So definitely we send a huge thanks out to everybody who's had the faith and trust in us, because, I mean, crowdfunding is a tough thing to make work, and every time you try and launch a campaign, what you're asking your fans to do is trust that they're going to like music you haven't even written yet a year from now.
Yeah.
And invest their money in the idea that they're going to be happy with the results. So, big kudos to the fans who have the courage to support bands and make it possible for them to survive in a new economy.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Brian. I just hope the best for the band, and we'll have to keep in touch.
Sounds good. Thanks, John.
Thank you. And I appreciate everybody listening to John Talk Radio tonight, and we'll talk to everybody next week.
All right. Thank you. Cheers.
Good night.
Let's go. And sometimes you gotta break in the back door and make yourself at home. So I wander the hall like a comp on the beat, whistling the stars and stripes a little out of key. I stole the president's shoes. I stole the president's shoes. My face. I filled my cup and I cleaned the floor, and I know I'm better for it. If your body slowly tells you you've done something, if the sun is in your eyes and you're alive, if your heart is worn, it's 'cause you love someone, and when you die, like a monarch in El Paso. It's a rusty bus from the mountainside, and we're passing.